night. Down below, men who had run and shouted in the wake of the early morning's assassinations were running and shouting again. "It's the biggest reaping firework that ever was," Coral said in a low voice. Before Jonas could reply, there was a hard hammering on the bedroom door. It was thrown open a second later, and Clay Reynolds came clumping across the room, wearing a pair of blue jeans and nothing else. His hair was wild, his eyes were wilder. "Bad news from town, Eldred," he said. "Dearborn and the other two in-world brats, 3 more explosions, falling almost on top of each other. From the blazing Sitgo oil patch, a great red-orange fireball rose lazily into the black of night, faded, disappeared." Reynolds walked out onto the balcony and stood between them at the railing, unmindful of their nakedness. He stared at the fireball with wide, wondering eyes until it was gone. As gone as the brats. Jonas felt that curious, debilitating gloom trying to steal over him again.
"How did they get away?" he asked. "Do you know? Does Avery?"
"Avery's dead. The deputy who was with him, too. 'Twas another deputy found him, Todd Bridger. Eldred, what's going on out there? What happened?"
"Oh, that's your boys," Coral said. "Didn't take them long to start their own reaping party, did it?"
"How much heart do they have?" Jonas asked himself. It was a good question, maybe the only one that mattered. Were they now done making trouble, or just getting started? He once more wanted to be out of here, out of Seafront, out of Hambry, out of Magus. Suddenly, more than anything, he wanted to be miles and wheels and leagues away. He had bounded around his hillock, it was too late to go back, and now he felt horribly exposed.
"Clay?"
"Yes, Eldred?" But the man's eyes and his mind were still on the conflagration at Sitgo. Jonas took his shoulder and turned Reynolds toward him. Jonas felt his own mind starting to pick up speed, ticking past points and details, and welcomed the feeling. That queer, dark sense of fatalism faded and disappeared.
"How many men are here?" he asked.
Reynolds frowned, thought about it.
35, he said, "maybe."
"How many armed?"
"With guns?"
"No, with pea-blowers, you damn fool."
"Probably," Reynolds pulled his lower lip, frowning more fiercely than ever,
"probably a dozen. That's guns likely to work, you can."
"The big boys from the Horsemen's Association still all here?"
"I think so."
"Get Lengel and Renfrew. At least you won't have to wake him up. They'll all be up, and most of them right down there."
Jonas jerked a thumb at the courtyard.
"Tell Renfrew to put together an advance party. Armed men. I'd like 8 or 10, but I'll take 5. Have that old woman's cart harnessed to the strongest, hardiest pony this place has got. Tell that old fuck Miguel that if the pony he chooses dies in the traces between here and Hanging Rock, he'll be using his wrinkled old balls for earplugs."
Coral Thorin barked brief, harsh laughter. Reynolds glanced at her, did a double take at her breasts, then looked back at Jonas with an effort.
"Where's Roy?"
Jonas asked. Reynolds looked up.
"Third floor with some little serving maid?" "Kick him out," Jonas said. "It's his job to get the old bitch ready to ride."
"We're going?"
"Soon as we can. You and me first with Renfrew's boys and Lengel behind with the rest of the men. You just make sure Hash Renfrew's with us, Clay. That man's got sand in his craw."
"What about the horses out on the drop?"
"Never mind the ever-fucking horses."
There was another explosion at Sitgo. Another fireball floated into the sky. Jonas couldn't see the dark clouds of smoke which must be rushing up, or smell the oil. The wind, out of the east and into the west, would be carrying both away from town.
"But just do as I say."
Jonas now saw his priorities in clear ascending order. The horses were on the bottom. Farson could find horses damn near anywhere. Above them were the tankers gathered at Hanging Rock. They were more important than ever now because the source was gone. Lose the tankers, and the big coffin hunters could forget going home. Yet most important of all was Farson's little piece of the Wizard's Rainbow. It was the one truly irreplaceable item. If it was broken, let it be broken in the care of George Letigo, not that of Eldred Jonas.
"Get moving," he told Reynolds. "De Pape rides after with Lengel's men, you with me. Go on, make it happen."
"And me?"
Coral asked. He reached out and tugged her toward him.
"I ain't forgot you, darling," he said.
Coral nodded and reached between his legs, oblivious of the staring Clay Reynolds.
"Aye," she said, "and I ain't forgot you."
4. They escaped Sitko with ringing ears and slightly singed around the edges, but not really hurt. Shimi riding double behind Cuthbert and Capricoso clattering after at the end of his long lead. It was Susan who came up with the place they should go, and like most solutions, it seemed completely obvious once someone had thought of it. And so, not long after Reaping Eve had become Reaping Morn, the five of them came to the hut in the bad grass where Susan and Roland had on several occasions met to make love. Cuthbert and Alain unrolled blankets, then sat on them to examine the guns they had liberated from the sheriff's office. They had also found Bert's slingshot. "These are hard calibers," Alain said, holding one up with a cylinder sprung and peering one-eyed down the barrel. "If they don't throw too high or wide, Roland, I think we can do some business with them." "I wish we had that rancher's machine gun," Cuthbert said wistfully. "You know what Court would say about a gun like that?" Roland asked, and Cuthbert burst out laughing. So did Alain.
"Who's Court?" Susan asked.
"The tough man Eldred Jonas only thinks he is," Alain said. "He was our teacher." Roland suggested that they catch an hour or two of sleep. The next day was apt to be difficult. That it might also be their last was something he didn't feel he had to say. "Alain, are you listening?" Alain, who knew perfectly well that Roland wasn't speaking of his ears or his attention span, nodded. "Do you hear anything?"
"Not yet."
"Keep at it."
"I will. But I can't promise anything. The touch is fluky, you know that as well as I do."
"Just keep trying." Shimi had carefully spread two blankets in the corner next to his proclaimed best friend.
"He's Roland, and he's Alain. Who are you, good old Arthur Heath? Who are you, really?"
"Cuthbert's my name." He stuck out his hand. "Cuthbert Allgood. How do you do, and how do you do, and how do you do again?" Shimi shook the offered hand, then began giggling. It was a cheerful, unexpected sound, and made them all smile. Smiling hurt Roland a little, and he guessed that if he could see his own face, he'd observe a pretty good burn from being so close to the exploding derricks.
"Cuthbert," Shimi said, giggling. "Oh, my, Cuthbert. That's a funny name. No wonder you're such a funny fellow. Cuthbert. Oh, that's a pip, a real pip."
Cuthbert smiled and nodded. "Can I kill him now, Roland, if we don't need him any longer?" "Save him a bit, why don't you?" Roland said. Then turned to Susan, his own smile fading. "Will thee walk out with me a bit, Sue? I'd talk to thee." She looked up at him, trying to read his face.
"All right."
She held out her hand. Roland took it. They walked into the moonlight together. And beneath its light, Susan felt dread take hold of her heart. Five. They walked out in silence through sweet-smelling grass that tasted good to cows and horses, even as it was expanding in their bellies, first bloating and then killing them. It was high, at least a foot taller than Roland's head, and still green as summer. Children sometimes got lost in the bad grass and died there, but Susan had never feared to be here with Roland, even when there were no sky markers to steer by. His sense of direction was uncannily perfect. "Sue, thee disobeyed me in the matter of the guns," he said at last. She looked at him, smiling, half amused and half angry.
"Does thee wish to be back in thy cell, then, thee and thy friends?"
"No, of course not. Such bravery." He held her close and kissed her. When he drew back, they were both breathing hard. He took her by the arms and looked into her eyes. "But thee mustn't disobey me this time." She looked at him steadily, saying nothing. "Thee knows," he said, "thee knows what I'd tell thee."
"Aye, perhaps."
"Say. Better you than me, maybe."
"I'm to stay at the hut while you and the others go. Shimi and I are to stay."
He nodded. "Will you? Will thee?" She thought of how unfamiliar and wretched Roland's gun had felt in her hand as she held it beneath the serape, of the wide, unbelieving look in Dave's eyes as the bullet she'd fired into his chest flung him backward, of how the first time she'd tried to shoot Sheriff Avery, the bullet had only succeeded in setting her own clothing afire, although he had been right there in front of her. They didn't have a gun for her, unless she took one of Roland's. She couldn't use one very well in any case. And more important, she didn't want to use one. Under those circumstances, and with Shimi to think about, too, it was best she just stay out of the way. Roland was waiting patiently. She nodded.
"Shimi and I'll wait for thee, it's my promise."
He smiled, relieved.
"Now pay me back with honesty, Roland."
"If I can." She looked up at the moon, shuddered at the ill-omened face she saw, and looked back at Roland.
"What chance thee'll come back to me?"
He thought about this very carefully, still holding to her arms. "Far better than Jonas thinks," he said at last. "We'll wait at the edge of the bad grass and should be able to mark his coming well enough."
"Aye, the herd of horses I saw,
he may come without the horses," Roland said, not knowing how well he had matched Jonas's thinking. "But his folk will make noise even if they come without the herd. If there's enough of them, we'll see them as well. They'll cut a line through the grass like a part in hair." Susan nodded. She had seen this many times from the drop, the mysterious parting of the bad grass as groups of men rode through it.
"If they're looking for thee, Roland? If Jonas sends scouts ahead?"
"I doubt he'll bother," Roland shrugged. "If they do, why, we'll kill them. Silent, if we can. Killing's what we were trained to do. We'll do it." She turned his hands over, and now she was gripping his arms instead of the other way around. She looked impatient and afraid.
"Thee hasn't answered my question. What chance I'll see thee back?"
He thought it over. "Even toss," he said at last. She closed her eyes as if struck, drew in a breath, let it out, opened her eyes again.
"Bad," she said. "Yet maybe not as bad as I thought. And if thee doesn't come back, Shimi and I go west, as thee said before?"
"Aye, to Gilead. There'll be a place of safety and respect for you there, dear, no matter what. But it's especially important that you go if you don't hear the tankers explode. Thee knows that, doesn't he?"
"To warn your people, thy quartet."
Roland nodded.
"I'll warn them, no fear, and keep Shimi safe, too. He's as much the reason we've got this far as anything I've done."
Roland was counting on Shimi for more than she knew. If he and Bert and Alain were killed, it was Shimi who would stabilize her, give her reason to go on.
"When does thee leave?" Susan asked. "Do we have time to make love?"
"We have time, but perhaps it's best we don't," he said. "It's going to be hard enough to leave thee again without... unless you really want to." His eyes half pleaded with her to say yes.
"Let's just go back and lie down a bit," she said, and took his hand.
For a moment it trembled on her lips to tell him that she was kindled with his child, but at the last moment she kept silent. There was enough for him to think about without that added mayhap, and she didn't want to pass such happy news beneath such an ugly moon. It would surely be bad luck. They walked back through high grass that was already springing together along their path. Outside the hut, he turned her toward him, put his hands on her cheeks, and softly kissed her again. "I will love thee forever, Susan," he said. "Come whatever storms." She smiled. The upward movement of her cheeks spilled a pair of tears from her eyes.
"Come whatever storms," she agreed.
She kissed him again, and they went inside. 6. The moon had begun to descend when a party of 8 rode out beneath the arch with "Come in Peace" writ upon it in the great letters. Jonas and Reynolds were in the lead. Behind them came Rhea's black wagon, drawn by a trotting pony that looked strong enough to go all night and half the next day. Jonas had wanted to give her a driver, but Rhea refused.
"Never was an animal I didn't get on with better than any man ever could,"
she told him, and that seemed to be true. The reins lay limp in her lap. The pony worked smart without them. The other five men consisted of Hash Renfrew, Quint, and three of Renfrew's best vaqueros. Coral had wanted to come as well, but Jonas had different ideas.
"If we're killed, you can go on more or less as before," he'd said. "There'll be nothing to tie you to us."
"Without ye, I'm not sure there'd be any reason to go on," she said.
"Ah, quit that schoolgirl shit. It don't become you. You'd find plenty of reasons to keep staggering down the path if you had to put your mind to it. If all goes well, as I expect it will, and ye still want to be with me, ride out of here as soon as you get word of our success. There's a town west of here in the Vicastus Mountains, Ritzy. Go there on the fastest horse you can swing a leg over. You'll be there ahead of us by days, no matter how smart we're able to push along. Find a respectable inn that'll take a woman on her own, if there is such a thing in Ritzy. Wait. When we get there with the tankers, you just fall into the column at my right hand. Have you got it?"
She had it. One woman in a thousand was Coral Thorin, sharp as Lord Satan and able to fuck like Satan's favorite harlot. Now, things only turned out to be as simple as he'd made them sound. Jonas fell back until his horse was pacing alongside the black cart. The ball was out of its bag and lay in Rhea's lap.
"Anything?"
he asked. He both hoped and dreaded to see that deep pink pulse inside it again.
"Nay, it'll speak when it needs to, though. Count on it."
"Then what good are you, old woman?"
"You'll know when the time comes," Rhea said, looking at him with arrogance, and some fear as well, he was happy to see.
Jonas spurred his horse back to the head of the little column. He had decided to take the ball from Rhea at the slightest sign of trouble. In truth, it had already inserted its strange, addicting sweetness into his head. He thought about that single pink pulse of light he'd seen far too much.
"Balls," he told himself, "battle sweat's all I've got. Once this business is over, I'll be my old self again."
Nice, if true, but he had, in truth, begun to wonder. Renfrew was now riding with Clay. Jonas nudged his horse in between them. His dicky leg was aching like a bastard, another bad sign.
"Langell?"
he asked Renfrew.
"Putting together a good bunch," Renfrew said. "Don't you fear friend Langell. 30 men.
30?
God, Harry's body, I told you I wanted 40 at least."
Renfrew measured him with a pale-eyed glance, then winced at a particularly vicious gust of the freshening wind. He pulled his neckerchief up over his mouth and nose. The vax riding behind had already done so.
"How afraid of these 3 boys are you, Jonas?"
"Afraid for both of us, I guess, since you're too stupid to know who they are or what they're capable of."
He raised his own neckerchief, then forced his voice into a more reasonable timbre. It was best he do so. He needed these bumpkins yet a while longer. Once the ball was turned over to Letigo, that might change.
"Though mayhap we'll never see them.
It's likely they're already 30 miles from here and riding west as fast as their horses will take 'em,"
Renfrew agreed.
"I'd give a crown to know how they got loose."
"What does it matter, you idiot?" Jonas thought, but said nothing.
"As for Langill's men, they'll be the hardest boys he can lay hands on. If it comes to a fight, those 30 will fight like 60.
Jonas's eyes briefly met Clay's.
"I'll believe it when I see it," Clay's brief glance said,
and Jonas knew again why he had always liked this one better than Roy DePape.
"How many armed?"
"With guns?
Maybe half. They'll be no more than an hour behind us."
Good. At least their back door was covered. It would have to do. And he couldn't wait to be rid of that thrice-cursed ball.
"Oh?"
whispered a sly, half-mad voice from a place much deeper than his heart.
"Oh, can't you?"
Jonas ignored the voice until it stilled. Half an hour later, they turned off the road and onto the drop. Several miles ahead, moving in the wind like a silver sea, was the Badgrass. 7. Around the time that Jonas and his party were riding down the drop, Roland, Cuthbert, and Alain were swinging up into their saddles. Susan and Shimi stood by the doorway to the hut, holding hands and watching them solemnly. "They'll hear the explosions when the tankers go, and smell the smoke," Roland said. "Even with the wind the wrong way, I think they'll smell it." Then, no more than an hour later, more smoke. "There," he pointed. "That'll be the brush piled in front of the canyon's mouth."
"And if we don't see those things?"
"Into the west. But thee will, Sue. I swear thee will." She stepped forward, put her hands on his thigh, and looked up at him in the latening moonlight. He bent, put his hand lightly against the back of her head, put his mouth on her mouth.
"Go that course in safety,"
Susan said as she drew back from him.
"Aye,"
Shimi added suddenly.
"Stand and be true, all three."
He came forward himself and shyly touched Cuthbert's boot. Cuthbert reached down, took Shimi's hand, and shook it. "Take care of her, old boy." Shimi nodded seriously.
"I will."
"Come on," Roland said. He felt that if he looked at her solemn, upturned face again, he would cry. "Let's go." They rode slowly away from the hut. Before the grass closed behind them, hiding it from view, he looked back a final time. "Sue, I love thee." She smiled. It was a beautiful smile.
"Bird and bear and hare and fish," she said.
The next time Roland saw her, she was caught inside the wizard's glass. Eight. What Roland and his friends saw west of the Badgrass had a harsh, lonely beauty. The wind was lifting great sheets of sand across the stony desert floor. The moonlight turned these into foot-racing phantoms. At moments, Hanging Rock was visible, some 2 wheels distant, and the mouth of Eyebolt Canyon 2 wheels farther on. Sometimes both were gone, hidden by the dust. Behind them, the tall grass made a soughing, singing sound. "How do you boys feel?" Roland asked. "All's well?" They nodded. "There's going to be a lot of shooting, I think."
"We'll remember the faces of our fathers," Cuthbert said.
"Yes," Roland agreed, almost absently. "We'll remember them very well." He stretched in the saddle. "The wind's in our favor, not theirs, that's one good thing. We'll hear them coming. We must judge the size of the group, all right?" They both nodded. "If Jonas has still got his confidence, he'll come soon in a small party, whatever gunnies he can put together on short notice, and he'll have the ball. In that case, we'll ambush them, kill them all, and take the wizard's rainbow." Alain and Cuthbert sat quiet, listening intently. The wind gusted, and Roland clapped a hand to his hat to keep it from flying off. "If he fears more trouble from us, I think he's apt to come later on, and with a bigger party of riders. If that happens, we'll let them pass. Then, if the wind is our friend and keeps up, we'll fall in behind them." Cuthbert began to grin. "Oh, Roland," he said, "your father would be proud. Only 14, but cozy as the devil."
15 come next moonrise," Roland said seriously.
"If we do it this way, we may have to kill their drogue riders. Watch my signals, all right?" "We're going to cross to Hanging Rock as part of their party?" Alain asked. He had always been a step or two behind Cuthbert, but Roland didn't mind. Sometimes reliability was better than quickness. "Is that it?"
"If the cards fall that way, yes."
"If they've got the pink ball with them, you better hope it doesn't give us away," Alain said. Cuthbert looked surprised. Roland bit his lip, thinking that sometimes Alain was plenty quick. Certainly he had come up with this unpleasant little idea ahead of Bert, ahead of Roland, too. We've got a lot to hope for this morning, but we'll play our cards as they come off the top of the pack. They dismounted and sat by their horses there on the edge of the grass, saying little. Roland watched the silver clouds of dust racing each other across the desert floor and thought of Susan. He imagined them married, living in a freehold somewhere south of Gilead. By then Farson would have been defeated, the world's strange decline reversed. A childish part of him simply assumed that making an end to John Farson would somehow see to that, and his gunslinging days would be over. Less than a year it had been since he had won the right to carry the six-shooters he wore on his hips, and to carry his father's great revolvers when Stephen Deschaine decided to pass them on, and already he was tired of them. Susan's kisses had softened his heart and quickened him somehow, had made another life possible. A better one, perhaps. One with a house and kiddies, and they're coming, Alain said, snapping Roland out of his reverie. The gunslinger stood up, Rusher's reins in one fist. Cuthbert stood tensely nearby. Large party or small? Do you know? Alain stood facing southeast, hands held out with the palms up. Beyond his shoulder, Roland saw Old Star just about to slip below the horizon, only an hour until dawn then.
I can't tell yet, Alain said.
Can you at least tell if the ball...
No, shut up, Roland, let me listen.
Roland and Cuthbert stood and watched Alain anxiously, at the same time straining their ears to hear the hooves of horses, the creak of wheels, or the murmur of men on the passing wind. Time spun out. The wind, rather than dropping as Old Star disappeared and dawn approached, blew more fiercely than ever. Roland looked at Cuthbert, who had taken out his slingshot and was playing nervously with the pull. Bert raised one shoulder in a shrug.
"It's a small party," Alain said suddenly. "Can either of you touch them?"
They shook their heads.
"No more than 10. Maybe only 6.
"Gods," Roland murmured, and pumped a fist at the sky. He couldn't help it.
"And the ball?"
"I can't touch it," Alain said. He sounded almost as though he were sleeping himself.
"But it's with them, don't you think?"
Roland did. A small party of 6 or 8, probably traveling with the ball. It was perfect. "Be ready, boys," he said. "We're going to take them." 9. Jonas's party made good time down the drop and into the bad grass. The guide stars were brilliant in the autumn sky, and Renfrew knew them all. He had a click line to measure between the two he called the twins, and he stopped the group briefly every 20 minutes or so to use it. Jonas hadn't the slightest doubt the old cowboy would bring them out of the tall grass pointed straight at Hanging Rock. Then, about an hour after they'd entered the bad grass, Quint rode up beside him.
"That old lady, she want to see you, Si. She say it's important."
"Do she now?" Jonas asked.
"Aye."
Quint lowered his voice.
"That ball she got on her lap all glowy."
"Is that so?"
"I'll tell you what, Quint, keep my old trail buddies company while I see what's what."
He dropped back until he was pacing beside the black cart. Rhea raised her face to him, and for a moment, washed as it was in the pink light, he thought it the face of a young girl.
"So," she said, "here you are, big boy. I thought you'd show up pretty smart."
She cackled, and as her face broke into its sour lines of laughter, Jonas again saw her as she really was, all but sucked dry by the thing in her lap. Then he looked down at it himself and was lost. He could feel that pink glow radiating into all the deepest passages and hollows of his mind, lighting them up in a way they'd never been lit up before. Even Coral, at her dirty busiest, couldn't light him up that way.
"You like it, don't ye?" she half laughed, half crooned. "Aye, so you do. So would anyone, such a pretty glam it is. But what do you see?" sighed Jonas.
Leaning over, holding to the saddle horn with one hand, his long hair hanging down in a sheaf, Jonas looked deeply into the ball. At first he saw only that luscious labial pink, and then it began to draw apart. Now he saw a hut surrounded by tall grass, the sort of hut only a hermit could love. The door, it was painted a peeling but still bright red, stood open. And sitting there on the stone stoop, with her hands in her lap, her blankets on the ground at her feet, and her unbound hair around her shoulders, was... "I'll be damned," Jonas whispered. He had now leaned so far out of the saddle that he looked like a trick rider in a circus show, and his eyes seemed to have disappeared. There were only sockets of pink light where they had been. Rhea cackled delightedly.
"Ay, it's Thorin's Jilly that never was. Dearborn's lover girl."
Her cackling stopped abruptly.
"Lover girl of the young proddy who killed my Ermot. And he'll pay for it, aye, so he will. Look closer, sighed Jonas. Look closer."
He did. Everything was clear now, and he thought he should have seen it earlier. Everything this girl's aunt had feared had been true. Rhea had known, although why she hadn't told anyone, the girl had been screwing one of the in-world boys. Jonas didn't know. And Susan had done more than just screw Will Dearborn. She'd helped him escape, him and his trailmates, and she might well have killed two lawmen for him into the bargain. The figure in the ball swam closer. Watching that made him feel a little dizzy, but it was a pleasant dizziness. Beyond the girl was the hut, faintly lit by a lamp which had been turned down to the barest core of flame. At first Jonas thought someone was sleeping in one corner, but on second glance he decided it was only a heap of hides that looked vaguely human.
"Do we spy the boys?" Rhea asked, seemingly from a great distance. "Do we spy him, my lord Sigh?"
"No," he said, his own voice seeming to come from that same distant place. His eyes were pinned to the ball. He could feel its light baking deeper and deeper into his brain. It was a good feeling, like a hot fire on a cold night.
"She's alone. Looks as if she's waiting."
"Aye."
Rhea gestured above the ball, a curt dusting-off movement of the hands, and the pink light was gone. Jonas gave a low, protesting cry, but no matter, the ball was dark again. He wanted to stretch his hands out and tell her to make the light return, to beg her if necessary, and held himself back by pure force of will. He was rewarded by a slow return of his wits. It helped to remind himself that Rhea's gestures were as meaningless as the puppets in a Pinch and Jilly show. The ball did what it wanted, not what she wanted. Meanwhile, the ugly old woman was looking at him with eyes that were perversely shrewd and clear.
"Waiting for what, do we suppose?" she asked.
There was only one thing she could be waiting for, Jonas thought with rising alarm. The boys, the three beardless sons of bitches from Inworld. And if they weren't with her, they might well be up ahead, doing their own waiting. Waiting for him. Possibly even waiting for...
"Listen to me," he said. "I'll only speak once, and you best answer true. Do they know about that thing? Do those three boys know about the rainbow?" Her eyes shifted away from his.
It was answer enough in one way, but not in another. She had had things her way all too long up there on her hill. She had to know who was boss down here. He leaned over again and grabbed her shoulder. It was horrible, like grabbing a bare bone that somehow still lived, but he made himself hold on all the same, and squeeze. She moaned and wriggled, but he held on.
"Tell me, you old bitch, run your fucking gob!" "They might know of it," she whined. "The girl might have seen something the night she came to be. Arr! Let go, you're killing me."
"If I wanted to kill you, you'd be dead." He took another longing glance at the ball, then sat up straight in the saddle, cupped his hands around his mouth, and called,
"Clay, hold up!"
As Reynolds and Renfrew reined back, Jonas raised a hand to halt the vax behind him. The wind whispered through the grass, bending it, rippling it, whipping up eddies of sweet smell. Jonas stared ahead into the dark, even though he knew it was fruitless to look for them. They could be anywhere, and Jonas didn't like the odds in an ambush, not one bit. He rode to where Clay and Renfrew were waiting. Renfrew looked impatient.
"What's the problem? Dawn will be breaking soon. We ought to get a move on. Do you know the hut's in the bad grass?"
"Aye, most. Why, do you know one with a red door?"
Renfrew nodded and pointed northish.
"Well, old Sunni's place.
He had some sort of religious conversion, a dream or a vision or something. That's when he painted the door of his hut red. He's gone to the Manny folk these last 5 years."
He no longer asked why, at least. He had seen something on Jonas's face that had shut up his questions. Jonas raised his hand, looked at the blue coffin tattooed there for a second, then turned and called for Quint.
"You're in charge," Jonas told him.
Quint's shaggy eyebrows shot up.
"Me?"
"Yeah, but you're not going on. There's been a change of plan."
"What? Listen, and don't open your mouth again unless there's something you don't understand. Get that damn black cart turned around. Put your men around it and hie on back the way we came. Join up with Lengel and his men. Tell them Jonas says wait where you find him until he and Reynolds and Renfrew come. Clear?"
Quint nodded. He looked bewildered, but said nothing.
"Good. Get about it. And tell the witch to put her toy back in its bag."
Jonas passed a hand over his brow. Fingers which had rarely shaken before had now picked up a minute tremble.
"It's distracting."
Quint started away, then looked back when Jonas called his name.
"I think those in-world boys are out here, Quint. Probably ahead of where we are now, but if they're back the way you're going, they'll probably set on you."
Quint looked nervously around at the grass, which rose higher than his head. Then his lips tightened and he returned his attention to Jonas.
"If they attack, they'll try to take the ball," Jonas continued. "And sigh, mark me well. Any man who doesn't die protecting it will wish he had."
He lifted his chin at the Vax, who sat astride their horses in a line behind the black cart.
"Tell them that."
"Aye, boss," Quint said. "When you reach Langill's party, you'll be safe. How long should we wait for you if you don't come?"
"Till hell freezes over. Now go."
As Quint left, Jonas turned to Reynolds and Renfrew.
"We're going to make a little side trip, boys," he said.
Ten. "Roland." Alain's voice was low and urgent. "They've turned around."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes. There's another group coming along behind them, a much larger one. That's where they're headed."
"Safety in numbers, that's all," Cuthbert said.
"Do they have the ball?" Roland asked. "Can you touch it yet?"
"Yes, they have it. It makes them easy to touch, even though they're going the other way now. Once you find it, it glows like a lamp in a mine shaft."
"Does Rhea still have the keeping of it?"
"I think so. It's awful to touch her."
"Jonas is afraid of us," Roland said. "He wants more men around him when he comes. That's what it is. What it must be." Unaware that he was both right and badly out in his reckoning. Unaware that for one of the few times since they had left Gilead, he had lapsed into a teenager's disastrous certainty.
"What do we do?" Alain asked.
"Sit here. Listen. Wait. They'll bring the ball this way again if they're going to Hanging Rock. They'll have to."
"Susan?" Cuthbert asked. "Susan and Sheeny, what about them? How do we know they're all right?"
"I suppose that we don't." Roland sat down, cross-legged, with Rusher's trailing reins in his lap. "But Jonas and his men will be back soon enough, and when they come we'll do what we must." 11. Susan hadn't wanted to sleep inside. The hut felt wrong to her without Roland. She had left Shimi huddled under the old hides in the corner and taken her own blankets outside. She sat in the hut's doorway for a little while, looking up at the stars and praying for Roland in her own fashion. When she began to feel a little better, she lay down on one blanket and pulled the other over her. It seemed an eternity since Maria had shaken her out of her heavy sleep, and the open-mouthed glottal snores drifting out of the hut didn't bother her much. She slept with her head pillowed on one arm, and didn't wake when 20 minutes later Shimi came to the doorway, blinked at her sleepily, and then walked off into the grass to urinate. The only one to notice him was Capricoso, who stuck out his long muzzle and took a nip at Shimi's butt as the boy passed him. Shimi, still mostly asleep, reached back and pushed the muzzle away. He knew Cappy's tricks well enough, so he did. Susan dreamed of the willow grove, bird and bear and hare and fish. And what woke her wasn't Shimi's return from his necessary, but a cold circle of steel pressing into her neck. There was a loud click that she recognized at once from the sheriff's office, a pistol being cocked. The willow grove faded from the eye of her mind. "Shine, little sunbeam," said a voice. For a moment her bewildered, half-waking mind tried to believe it was yesterday, and Maria wanted her to get up and out of Seafront before whoever had killed Mayor Thorin and Chancellor Reimer could come back and kill her as well. No good. It wasn't the strong light of mid-morning that her eyes opened upon, but the ash-pallid glow of 5 o'clock. Not a woman's voice, but a man's, and not a hand shaking her shoulder, but the barrel of a gun against her neck. She looked up and saw a lined, narrow face framed by white hair, lips no more than a scar, eyes the same faded blue as Roland's. Eldred Jonas. The man standing behind him had bought her own dad drinks once upon a happier time, Hash Renfrew. A third man, one of Jonas's quartet, ducked into the hut. Freezing terror filled her midsection, some for her, some for Shimi. She wasn't sure the boy would even understand what was happening to them. "These are two of the three men who tried to kill him," she thought. "He'll understand that much."
"Here you are, Sunbeam, here you come," Jonas said companionably, watching her blink away the sleep fog. "Good. You shouldn't be napping all the way out here on your own, not a pretty size such as yourself. But don't worry, I'll see you get back to where you belong."
His eyes flicked up as the redhead with the cloak stepped out of the hut. Alone?
"What you got in there, Clay, anything?"
Reynolds shook his head.
"All still on the horse, I reckon."
"Shimi," Susan thought. "Where are you, Shimi?" Jonas reached out and caressed one of her breasts briefly.
"Nice," he said, "tender and sweet. No wonder Dearborn likes you."
"Get your filthy blue-marked hand off me, you bastard!"
Smiling, Jonas did as she bid. He turned his head and regarded the mule.
"I know this one. It belongs to my good friend Coral, along with everything else you've turned livestock thief. Shameful, shameful, this younger generation, don't you agree, Sire Renfrew?"
But her father's old associate said nothing. His face was carefully blank, and Susan thought he might be just the tiniest tad ashamed of his presence here. Jonas turned back to her, his thin lips curved in the semblance of a benevolent smile.
"Well, after murder, I suppose stealing a mule comes easy, don't it?"
She said nothing, only watched as Jonas stroked Cappy's muzzle.
"What all were they hauling, those boys, that it took a mule to put it on?"
"Shrouds," she said through numb lips, "for you and all your friends. A fearful heavy load it made, too, near broke the poor animal's back."
"There's a saying in the land I come from," Jonas said, still smiling, "clever girls go to hell. Ever heard it?"
He went on stroking Cappy's nose. The mule liked it. His neck was thrust out to its full length, his stupid little eyes half-closed with pleasure.
"Has it crossed your mind that fellas who unload their pack animals, split up what it was carrying, and take the goods away, usually ain't coming back?"
Susan said nothing.
"You've been left high and dry, Sunbeam. Fast fucked is usually fast forgot, sad to say. Do you know where they went?"
"Yes," she said. Her voice was low, barely a whisper. Jonas looked pleased.
"If he was to tell, things might go easier for you. Would you agree, Renfrew?"
"Aye," Renfrew said. "They're traitors, Susan, for the good man. If you know where they are or what they're up to, tell us."
Keeping her eyes fixed on Jonas, Susan said, "Come closer." Her numbed lips didn't want to move, and it came out sounding like "Kung Gloser," but Jonas understood and leaned forward, stretching his neck in a way that made him look absurdly like Capricoso. When he did, Susan spat in his face. Jonas recoiled, lips twisting in surprise and revulsion. "Arr, bitch!" he cried, and launched a full-swung, open-handed blow that drove her to the ground. She landed at full length on her side with black stars exploding across her field of vision. She could already feel her right cheek swelling like a balloon and thought if he'd hit an inch or two lower, he might have broken my neck. Mayhap that would have been best. She raised her hand to her nose and wiped blood from the right nostril. Jonas turned to Renfrew, who had taken a single step forward and then stopped himself.
"Put her on her horse and tie her hands in front of her. Tight!"
He looked down at Susan, then kicked her in the shoulder hard enough to send her rolling toward the hut.
"Spit on me, would you? Spit on Elder Jonas, would you, you bitch?"
Reynolds was holding out his neckerchief. Jonas took it, wiped the spittle from his face with it, then dropped into a hunker beside her. He took a handful of her hair and carefully wiped the neckerchief with it. Then he hauled her to her feet. Tears of pain now peeped from the corners of her eyes, but she kept silent.
"I may never see your friend again, sweet Sue, with the tender little titties, but I've got you, ain't I? Yarr. And if Dearborn gives us trouble, I'll give you double. And make sure Dearborn knows you may count on it."
His smile faded, and he gave her a sudden bitter shove that almost sent her sprawling again.
"Now get mounted, and do it before I decide to change your face a little with my knife."
12. Sheeny watched from the grass, terrified and silently crying, as Susan spit in the bad coffin hunter's face and was knocked to the ground, hit so hard the blow might have killed her. He almost rushed out then, but something, it could have been his friend Arthur's voice in his head, told him that would only get him killed. He watched as Susan mounted. One of the other men, not a coffin hunter, but a big rancher Sheeny had seen in the rest from time to time, tried to help, but Susan pushed him away with the sole of her boot. The man stood back with a red face.
"Don't make him mad, Susan," Sheeny thought. "Oh, gods, don't do that. They'll hit you some more. Oh, your poor face. And you got a nosebleed, so you do."
"Last chance," Jonas told her. "Where are they, and what do they mean to do?"
"Go to hell," she said.
He smiled, a thin, hurty smile. "Likely I'll find you there when I arrive," he said. Then, to the other coffin hunter, "You check the place careful?"
"Whatever they had, they took it," the redhead answered. "Only thing they left was Dearborn's punch bunny."
That made Jonas laugh meany-mean as he climbed on board his own horse.
"Come on," he said. "Let's ride."
They went back into the bad grass. It closed around them, and it was as if they had never been there, except that Susan was gone, and so was Cappy. The big rancher riding beside Susan had been leading the mule. When he was sure they weren't going to return, Sheeny walked slowly back into the clearing, doing up the button on top of his pants as he came. He looked from the way Roland and his friends had gone to the one in which Susan had been taken. Which? A moment's thought made him realize there was no choice. The grass out here was tough and springy.
The path Roland and Elaine and good old Arthur Heath, so Sheeny still thought of him and always would, had taken, was gone. The one made by Susan and her captors, on the other hand, was still clear, and perhaps if he followed her, he could do something for her, help her. Walking at first, then jogging, as his fear that they might double back and catch him dissipated, Sheeny went in the direction Susan had been taken. He would follow her most of that day. 13. Cuthbert, not the most sanguine of personalities in any situation, grew more and more impatient as the day brightened toward true dawn. "It's reaping," he thought, "finally reaping, and here we sit with our knives sharpened and not a thing in the world to cut." Twice he asked Elaine what he heard. The first time Elaine only grunted. The second time he asked what Bert expected him to hear with someone yapping away in his ear like that. Cuthbert, who did not consider two inquiries 15 minutes apart as yapping away, wandered off and sat morosely in front of his horse. After a bit, Roland came over and sat down beside him. "Waiting," Cuthbert said. "That's what most of our time in Magus has been about, and it's the thing I do worst." "You won't have to do it much longer," Roland said. 14. Jonas's company reached the place where Fran Lengel's party had made a temporary camp about an hour after the sun had topped the horizon. Quint, Rhea, and Renfrew's Vax were already there and drinking coffee, Jonas was glad to see. Lengel started forward, saw Susan riding with her hands tied, and actually drew back a step, as if he wanted to find a corner to hide in. There were no corners out here, however, so he stood fast. He did not look happy about it, however. Susan nudged her horse forward with her knees, and when Reynolds tried to grab her shoulder, she dipped it to the side, temporarily eluding him. "Why, Francis Lengel, imagine meeting you here."
"Susan, I'm sorry to see you so," Lengel said.
His flush crept closer and closer to his brow, like a tide approaching a seawall.
"It's bad company you've fallen in with, girl, and in the end bad company always leaves you to face the music alone."
Susan actually laughed.
"Bad company," she said. "Ah, you'd know about that, wouldn't you, Fran?"
He turned, awkward and stiff in his embarrassment. She raised one booted foot, and before anyone could stop her, kicked him squarely between the shoulder blades. He went down on his stomach, his whole face widening in shocked surprise.
"No, you don't, you bold cunt!"
Renfrew shouted, and fetched her a wallop to the side of the head. It was on the left, and at least evened things up a bit, she would think later, when her mind cleared and she was capable of thinking. She swayed in the saddle, but kept her seat. And she never looked at Renfrew, only at Lengel, who had now managed to get to his hands and knees. He wore a deeply dazed expression.
"You killed my father!" she screamed at him. "You killed my father, you cowardly, sneaking excuse for a man!"
She looked at the party of ranchers and Vax, all of them staring at her now.
"There he is, Fran Lengel, head of the Horsemen's Association, as low as sneak as ever walked, low as coyote shit, low as—"
"That's enough," Jonas said, watching with some interest as Lengel scuttled back to his men. And yes, Susan was bitterly delighted to see it was a full-fledged scuttle, with his shoulders hunched. Rhea was cackling, rocking from side to side, and making a sound like fingernails on a piece of slate. The sound shocked Susan, but she wasn't a bit surprised by Rhea's presence in this company.
"It could never be enough,"
she said, looking from Jonas to Lengel with an expression of contempt so deep it seemed bottomless.
"For him it could never be enough."
"Well, perhaps. But you did quite well in the time you had, Lady Si. Few could have done better. And listen to the witch cackle, like salt in his wounds, I wot. But we'll shut her up soon enough." Then, turning his head, "Clay?" Reynolds rode up. "Think you can get Sunbeam back to Seafront all right?"
"I think so."
Reynolds tried not to show the relief he felt at being sent back east instead of west. He had begun to have a bad feeling about Hanging Rock, Latigo, the tankers, about the whole show, really.
God knew why.
Now?
Give it another minute, Jonas said. Mayhap there's going to be a spot of killing right here. Who knows? But it's the unanswered questions that makes it worthwhile getting up in the morning, even when a man's leg aches like a tooth with a hole in it, wouldn't you say so?
I don't know, Eldred.
Cy Renfrew, watch our pretty sunbeam a minute. I have a piece of property to take back.
His voice carried well, he had meant that it should, and Rhea's cackles cut off suddenly, as if severed out of her throat with a hooking knife. Smiling, Jonas walked his horse toward the black cart with its jostling show of gold symbols. Reynolds rode on his left, and Jonas sensed rather than saw DePape fall in on his right. Roy was a good enough boy, really. His head was a little soft, but his heart was in the right place, and you didn't have to tell him everything. For every step forward Jonas's horse took, Rhea shrank back a little in the cart. Her eyes shifted from side to side in their deep sockets, looking for a way out that wasn't there.
"Keep away from me, you chary man," she cried, raising a hand toward him. With the other she clutched the sack with the ball in it ever more tightly. "Keep away, or I'll bring the lightning and strike you dead where you sit your horse. Your hairier friends, too."
Jonas thought Roy hesitated briefly at that, but Clay never did, nor did Jonas himself. He guessed there was a great lot she could do, or that there had been at one time. But that was before the hungry glass had entered her life.
"Give it up to me," he said. He reached the side of her wagon and held his hand out for the bag. "It's not yours and never was. One day you'll doubtless have the good man's thanks for keeping it so well as you have, but now you must give it up."
She screamed, a sound of such piercing intensity that several of the vaqueros dropped their tin coffee cups and clapped their hands over their ears. At the same time, she nodded her hand through the drawstring and raised the bag over her head. The curved shape of the ball swung back and forth at the bottom of it like a pendulum.
"I'll not," she howled. "I'll smash it on the ground before I give it up to the likes of you."
Jonas doubted if the ball would break, not hurled by her weak arms onto the trampled, springy mat of the bad grass, but he didn't think he would have occasion to find out one way or the other.
"Clay," he said, "draw your gun."
He didn't need to look at Clay to see that he'd done it. He saw the frantic way her eyes shifted to the left where Clay sat his horse.
"I'm going to have a count," Jonas said. "Just a short one. If I get to three and she hasn't passed that bag over, blow her ugly head off."
"Aye."
"One," Jonas said, watching the ball pendulum back and forth at the bottom of the upheld bag. It was glowing. He could see dull pink even through the cloth.
"Two. Enjoy hell, Rhea. Goodbye."
"Three here,"
she screamed, thrusting it out toward him and shielding her face with the crooked hook of her free hand.
"Here, take it, and may it damn you the way it's damned me."
"Thank you, Cy." He grabbed the bag just below the draw top and yanked. Rhea screamed again as the string skinned her knuckles and tore off one of her nails. Jonas hardly heard. His mind was a white explosion of exultation. For the first time in his long professional life, he forgot his job, his surroundings, and the 6,000 things that could get him killed on any day. He had it. He had it. By all the graves of all the gods, he had the fucking thing.
"Mine,"
he thought, and that was all. He somehow restrained the urge to open the bag and stick his head inside it, like a horse sticking its head into a bag of oats, and looped the drawstring over the pommel of his saddle twice instead. He took in a breath as deep as his lungs would allow, then expelled it.
"Better. A little."
"Roy? Aye, Jonas?"
It would be good to get out of this place, Jonas thought, and not for the first time, to get away from these hicks. He was sick of I and ye, and so it is, sick to his bones.
"Roy, Well, give the bitch a 10 count this time. If she isn't out of my sight by then, you have my permission to blow her ass off. Now, let's see if you can do the counting. I'll be listening close, so mind you don't skip any. 1, DePape said eagerly. 2, 3, 4... Spitting curses, Rhea snatched up the reins of the cart and spanked the pony's back with them. The pony laid its ears back and jerked the cart forward so vigorously that Rhea went tumbling backward off the cantboard, her feet up, her white and bony shins showing above her ankle-high black shoes and mismatched wool stockings. The vaqueros laughed. Jonas laughed himself. It was pretty funny, all right, seeing her on her back with her pins in the air.
5,
DePape said, laughing so hard he was hiccuping.
6.
Rhea climbed back up, flopped onto the cantboard again with all the grace of a dying fish, and peered around at them, wall-eyed and sneering.
I curse ye all,
she screamed. It cut through them, stilling their laughter, even as the cart bounced toward the edge of the trampled clearing.
Every last one of ye, ye and ye and ye.
Her crooked finger pointed last at Jonas.
Thief, miserable thief.
As though it was yours, Jonas marveled, although mine was the first word to occur to him once he had taken possession of it. As though such a wonder could ever belong to a backcountry reader of rooster gut such as you. The cart bounced its way into the bad grass, the pony pulling hard with its ears laid back. The old woman's scream served to drive it better than any whip could have done. The black slipped into the green. They saw the cart flicker like